Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, some 40 million American adults in any given year may suffer from an anxiety disorder. This could include obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD, or other related anxiety disorders, from common phobias to panic attacks to social anxiety or post-traumatic stress. There are lots of reasons such disorders may manifest themselves. There are also various schools of thought about how to treat them. Today on the program, we'll learn more about OCD and related anxiety disorders as we talk with licensed clinical professional counselor Shayla Parker from Kevin Elliott Counseling in Champaign. Ms. Parker has worked as a counselor and group therapist in Champaign, Charleston, and the Chicago suburbs. At Linden Oaks Hospital, she trained in a new specialized program for patients suffering with anxiety disorders, which used cognitive behavioral therapy called exposure and response prevention. Shayla Parker, welcome to Focus.
Thanks, Craig. Thanks for having me today.
I'm glad to have you with us. As we begin our discussion, we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We welcome your questions on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Shayla, when we use the term anxiety disorder, what are we talking about?
Well, basically, there are several different kinds of anxiety disorders. So if you think of anxiety disorders, it's sort of a broad heading. And usually the distinguishing factor there is that people are experiencing all the different components of anxiety to a point where it's interfering with their life in some way. So there's a physical component of anxiety, or the physiological component, which is increased heart rate, sweating, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. There's the mental component, or the cognitive component, which is the thought patterns that come along with anxiety. And a lot of times this is predicting the worst case scenario or fearing the worst case scenario. And then also there's the behavioral component of anxiety, which is a lot of times what these are, avoidant behaviors, or what we call safety seeking behaviors, in order to try to reduce that anxiety. And when you have all those going on, which all of us do, by the way, we all have anxiety. But when somebody meets the criteria for an anxiety disorder, these symptoms are impacting their life to the point where their functioning is impacted.
Do each of those components sort of feed on each other?
They do. Once you know it starts, it sort of goes into this feedback loop. As an example, if somebody is experiencing a panic attack, they feel their heart rate increase possibly, or they start sweating, and then of course the thoughts come in. Oh my gosh, what is that? Is that, am I having a heart attack? Is that, and of course, if we have a thought like that,
it causes your heart rate to increase.
Our sweat heart
more.
Rate's going to go up.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we get more anxious. And
So then one of the components that turns it into a disorder is maybe that person can't turn that off, can't stop that cycle.
Right. And one of the components of that, too, is which is, I think, one of the more frustrating ones, is that people will say, I know this isn't logical. I know this. My doctor's told me. I've had all these tests, and I'm cleared. There's nothing physically wrong with me. Yet when I experience these panic attacks, I think I'm dying. And so that's frustrating, because they logically know that mm-hmm. it's a panic attack. Yet they feel like they just cannot get out of that cycle.
So there's a disconnect between the intellectual and the emotional in that moment.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. So you mentioned that this is sort of like an overall umbrella when we talk about anxiety disorder. So what classifications of disorders fall under that umbrella?
Well, right now there's there's social anxiety, panic disorder, with or without agoraphobia, post-traumatic stress disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder.
Social anxiety.
And then there's some phobias, things of that nature.
And then sort of a generalized anxiety also fall into that.
Yes.
All right. So part of what I must admit confuses me as someone who is, at least to my knowledge, not dealt with any of these, is what the difference is between social anxiety disorder and a panic disorder. What is the difference?
I think typically, you know, and that how I always describe it to people is like we said, so there's this umbrella of okay, we've got anxiety. And then I think of it as underneath this heading, there's these buckets. Mm-hmm. And these buckets are each of the, you know, so it's social anxiety, it's generalized anxiety is another bucket. And the distinguishing factor typically is how the anxiety is manifesting itself. And it's not uncommon for people who have anxiety disorders to actually have several symptoms falling into different buckets, mm-hmm. so to speak. So for generalized anxiety, for example, one of the ways, the main way that the anxiety is manifesting itself is in excessive worry. And it's worry of many things. It's not just a specific worry. And that is distinguished by, say, from social anxiety, because social anxiety is more a fear of judgment or negative judgment from other people. And so that's how it's manifesting in that way. And then with panic, there people are usually experiencing more physical symptoms of panic disorder in that way. So it really is sort of how the anxiety just is manifesting at the time. And that's what distinguishes the different anxiety disorders.
Okay. You mentioned phobias are sort of in this general category as mm-hmm. well. What gives rise to phobias, to fears of certain things?
Well, there's sort of a theory, I guess, amongst any of the anxiety disorders is that it's partly genetic, possibly. You know, hereditary-wise, but that's not 100% of it. And we know this because in studies of identical twins, one person who has an anxiety disorder of those twins does not always, the other one does not always. And so that would say it's not 100% genetic. So, but there is a component because often we'll see in families, you know, maybe somebody's mother, father, grandmother has fits a criteria for an anxiety disorder.
And but for phobias specifically, mm-hmm. I think of things like, okay, someone has a fear of, the common ones, I guess, are fear of heights or fear of small spaces or fear yeah. of spiders or whatever. What is it that's specific that triggers that particular fear?
Well, and that's where I think if there is possibly a genetic component of anxiety, say any kind of anxiety, that might be there. And then also some of the other factors that are involved could be a learned factor. So if I, let's say I grew up in a family and my mom in particular had a fear of water mm-hmm. without, you know, she's trying to protect me, obviously doing the best that she can. But even as a small child, we pick up on these cues of how she's pulling me a little closer when we're walking past the pool and maybe some verbal comments of like, no, you know, no, you don't go over there, you know, and don't get too close to the lake. Don't get, you know, which is very, again, this is very normal things that even people without phobias would want to protect their children. But I may have learned just a little bit to be a little bit more intensely cautious of water. And that is one of the factors, too, of anxiety. There's a caution about it. You heard the term viewing the world through rose-colored glasses. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when there's a description of someone struggling with an anxiety disorder, even a phobia, it's kind of like viewing the world through amber-colored or yellow-colored glasses, like the caution light at a stoplight, which is that sort of the view of the world is always a cautionary view, and it's more a presumption that something bad is going to happen. And so that might manifest in a phobia. So I might be more prone to water phobia if, say, my mother had been more cautious of me in that way. And maybe I did have a bad experience, too. That's another thing, our life experiences. So maybe I was at a pool party and I slipped off the edge, and it may have not have been as catastrophic as I remember, because obviously I'm still sitting here. But as a child, it may have really scared me. And so as a consequence of that, depending on how I dealt with it, if I just from that moment on really stayed away from water, the way the anxiety part of the brain works is that every time we do a behavior to avoid something we're anxious about, it actually becomes more anxious about it. So anxiety really does kind of grow over time versus had I fallen in and then maybe said, you know what, maybe somebody said, well, let's just try to get back in, and let's just, then that phobia probably wouldn't have taken as much hold.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is licensed clinical professional counselor Shayla Parker from Kevin Elliott Counseling in Champaign. We're discussing the symptoms, causes, and treatment options for anxiety disorders. This includes OCD, common phobias, panic attacks, social anxiety, and post-traumatic stress. We welcome your questions and comments, whether you yourself suffer from an anxiety disorder, or maybe someone close to you is dealing with such a disorder, or if you'd just like to know more about this particular area of mental health, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. Okay, so whether it's genetic or learned behavior or related in some way to some sort of trauma, how often does anxiety manifest itself in childhood and then really sort of become something you become aware of maybe as an adult? Does it usually start with childhood?
You know, it's interesting because with the different anxiety disorders, the onset is a little bit different for all of them. Mm-hmm. I would say a lot of the people I see, it's not uncommon just thinking about their response to this question. And a lot of people will say, you know, I've felt like this ever since I can remember. And so it definitely does seem to at times just kind of be an ingrained trait in people sometimes. Although I will say too, it's also not uncommon for people to say, you know, I never really had panic attacks before. And once we start getting into, you know, what's going on in their life, they might start talking about, well, we recently moved. I just got married. And so there's all of these stressors, even though they can be very good things, too. Even a good thing can be a stressful thing. And so sometimes that's one of the things research is looking at right now, is even though there's a genetic component at times, sometimes that they feel this genetic component can be triggered by stressors in life, and sort of that genetic component gets activated. Hmm. And so it can be both, I think.
What is obsessive compulsive disorder?
Obsessive compulsive disorder is when a person is experiencing obsessions, which are intrusive, unwanted thoughts, images. It can even be sounds that are kind of stuck in the person's head. And as a result of these intrusive thoughts and images, the person usually will engage in a compulsion, which a compulsion is a physical behavior, or it can also be a mental behavior in order to reduce the anxiety brought on by these unwanted thoughts. So as an example, if one of the common obsessions is fearing losing control. Mm-hmm. So if I'm walking down the sidewalk and I pass you, and I just had an image of myself sticking my leg out in front of you, people would say, well, why would I even think of that? I don't want to do that, but yet I had this thought. So it kind of scares the person because they think, well, I don't want to hurt people, you know, but I just imagined myself tripping that guy. So it brings on a lot of anxiety, and then they question they doubt their judgment. So mm-hmm. as you walk past, because I'm so nervous, I kind of look back maybe two or three times and make sure you're okay and that you're still walking. That would actually be the compulsion part of it, to reduce my fear. Maybe I really did trip him and I didn't realize it. And
all right, so this raises something interesting for me. I had this psych professor in college who liked to tell this story that he felt demonstrated the line between common day-to-day anxieties and something that maybe would require treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about this friend of his who was supposed to meet him one day and wound up arriving hours late.
Okay.
His friend had been driving down the highway and thought he hit something. And as any of us would do, he stopped. He looked around. He couldn't find anything. Got back in his car. So far, so good, right?
Right.
The prof said any of us would do that, but his friend then, after traveling several miles down the road, suddenly felt compelled to turn around and drive back to the same spot to check again because he convinced himself that he just hadn't looked carefully enough. Is that the line, or is that just a good story for Psych 101 students?
That's actually a good, I think that is a good example. Because, yeah, every single one of us has behaviors or checking types of things that we would do. Every single one of us, well, there's a recent study that suggested that 90% of the entire population has intrusive, unwanted thoughts, things like that. Just me picturing me tripping you or something.
You know, you're really fixated on that. I'm going to keep a wide berth when we leave the studio.
Where's your car? No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But the thing is, yeah, the difference is that when you have OCD, it's kind of like the sifting mechanism in the person's brain where we might get a thought of that, like, well, why would I think that? And we think, well, that's just kind of whatever. And the thought kind of gets thrown out. When somebody has OCD, that sifting mechanism kind of, it just won't let it go.
Whatever that thought is remains in there, and then some sort of behavior associated with it has to be exhibited. Is that the idea?
Right. So the guy, the example of hit, you're right, every person, if we heard something and thought we hit something, we might get out of our car, look around, make sure, you know, especially if, but most people wouldn't doubt their judgment to the point where they would come back after several miles. So the difference is the level that it's impacting the person's functioning, because we all do habits of, you know, how we brush our teeth a certain way and everything in the morning.
But. So there are habitual behaviors that are normal, but it's when it's getting in the way of your life and your ability to accomplish things that it's you've moved into maybe disorder territory.
Absolutely, yeah.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Shayla Parker. She's a licensed clinical professional counselor from Kevin Elliott Counseling in Champaign. She specializes in patients dealing with anxiety disorders like obsessive compulsive disorder or OCD, as well as social anxiety, post-traumatic stress, panic attacks, and phobias. We're learning more about such anxiety disorders, how they manifest themselves, and what treatment options are available. And we welcome you to the conversation with any questions you may have at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And we'll start this morning with Mike in Effingham. Mike, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't hope on this program articulated this story about myself before. But I'll go ahead. If you've heard it before, then stop me.
All right.
When I were a young person, 11 years old, I was in junior high and shooting spitwads. That was an old thing from my day, and I'm an old man now. But that was part of the observation and the understanding that that was doable. In the classroom, it was started. I blended in and did it. The teacher saw me and sent me to the principal's office. I'm 12, and this fellow is a fully grown man. And, you know, I'm looking up, and he said, sit down right there. And I did. And then he went about his business for 10 or 15 minutes, and he came over, laid a blank piece of paper on the desk that I was seated at, and pointed his finger at me and said, I want you to write down the other names of people who were doing what you were caught doing. So I sucked in a breath, and I thought, well, what do I do? My father, who was abusive, if I didn't write down, he's going to send a note home, and I'm going to get bumped there. And then I thought, well, what about the circumstances after I do this? So one, not to deny authority, I wrote them down. And school was out at 3:15, and I started walking home. I lived a mile from school. And about halfway home, I was surrounded by 13 boys, all about my age. And they began to call me all sorts of names and to proceed to bump me with their bicycles. And all I did was stand silent and looking into space. And after 15 minutes or so of abuse, they all dispersed and went away. So I became a loner after that, and I began to run. I'd get out of school, and I would run home. I encountered nobody till I finally dropped out of high school when I was 16. Well, my interest in telling the story plays into Wilhelm Reich's analysis and the character formations and all the other discombobulation that our species undergoes. And I would like to pose that, and if your guest would tell me before I ring off if whether or not she has ever heard of Dr. Reich.
Okay. Are you familiar with this, the individual he's referencing?
I'm not. So is there a book that, or some certain books that are...
Maybe I'll ask the guest if you could speak to specifically what it is about Reich's work that speaks to you or that you're curious about?
Well, his work is about the formation of the personality and how that occurs, the ramifications of that, and the history of psychoanalysis, whom Mr. Reich, a German psychologist who played into Freud's ideas and then surpassed Freud and went on to diagnose the mental illness that is created throughout our species. I'll give you one central line from his work of character analysis and the effects of patriots and patriotism and how that has evolved and how it guides our lives. And we learned it from when Mother was removed from her position of character formation with the offspring, and the nurture of those individuals, male and female, and her mothering experience, which is acquired quite young.
All right. I'm sorry to interrupt, Mike. I feel like we're veering a little far afield, but I do want to comment on your point.
I'm sorry. So, I didn't mean to.
That's okay. No, it's fine.
Right.
It's fine. Thanks very much for the call. And I guess where I'd like to take this based off of his story is getting back to the idea of anxiety disorders and what we're talking about today. How much of that can be manifested from the sort of traumatic event that he described?
Yeah, and that was actually a really good example of definitely, I think any of the listeners could see where that would provoke enormous amounts of anxiety, and understandably so, wanting to avoid that from ever happening again. So definitely something like that can contribute to anxiety disorders and things of that nature. And I think what Mike was mm-hmm. was also referring to also when he's talking about Freud, and I mean there's definitely legitimacy there, because even from the time we're pre-verbal, we are learning, and we are creatures of environment and learning without us even realizing it. So definitely, you know, as an example, like there are some people who had medical conditions when they were babies. And, you know, you think at a young age, like 10 days old or something, they were kept in an incubator, which is for their good. Obviously, mm-hmm. they were trying to help them survive. But there are some things, you know, stemming from that. You know, our anxiety response is still present, you know, from birth. It's one of the most primal parts of the brain. So our first experiences with the world and not being able to be held or touched and things of that nature, definitely anxiety is a huge...
To get back to Mike's point, though, beyond anxiety, can those things then lead to specific personality traits over the course of one's life. I mean, he talks about the fact that he was kind of a loner pretty much the rest of the way, and really kind of he seems to draw back to that particular incident as maybe the start of that attitude.
Yeah, I definitely think it could be. I think personality, I mean, it's interesting, you know, obviously, he couldn't have prevented that event from happening, just like all of us are going to have events that happen to us in our life. But a lot of times it's our response to those events that is also going to dictate the level of anxiety and also sort of our life patterns after that, too.
All right. Yeah. Let's take another call. We have Steve on the line from Eureka. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. Earlier in the program, you talked about thought management and dealing with anxiety, and I thought of an author who has helped me considerably. His name is David Burns, and he has 10 cognitive distortions, such as all-or-nothing thinking, jumping to conclusions, negative filter, personalization, discounting the positive. And I'm wondering if, are you familiar with David Burns's work, and do you find it helpful in dealing with person's anxieties and thought management?
Right. Yes, absolutely. Dr. Burns has wonderful work, and his work on cognitive behavioral therapy, the cognitive distortions you're talking about.
Yes,
those are definitely a component to anxiety treatment. And in fact, I have a list of those in my office. That's one of the handouts I always hand out to people. It's very, very helpful. So I definitely promote Dr. Burns's work. And
good. I'm glad you do. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. And we haven't had a chance yet to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder, and that falls into this same umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us, I think, are familiar with PTSD and are most familiar with it as something that someone coming back from a war zone may suffer from. What sorts of other events can trigger PTSD?
Yeah, any traumatic, right now the definition of person experiencing a trauma is that they have either witnessed or experienced a situation or event in which their life or another person's life seemed threatened in some way. And so that could be anything from a car accident, even Mike that called in earlier. You know, when you have people surrounding you like that, there is definitely, you don't know what those people are going to do. So, I mean, that could definitely, you know, classify as a trauma. So anything like that.
What makes an event traumatic to the point that PTSD can occur, where it becomes something that, or is it not fair maybe to define it by the event, but define it by the reaction to the event?
I think, you know, right now the strictest standard there is that sort of like the perception that your life or another's life was in danger. So that criteria is there at the moment. But yeah, there's a, you know, it's to be expected anytime a trauma has happened. So the first month after a trauma, it's actually classified as acute stress disorder, which is just the experiences people will have after experiencing a really, you know, a car accident or something. When it goes on longer than a month, you know, then we're looking at, is it now carrying on to the point where it's again interfering with the person's life? And then it might be classified as post-traumatic stress disorder, because some of the symptoms the person may experience might be traumatic nightmare, you know, nightmares of the event rehappening. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, as an example, if we use a non-war example, but in a car accident, there's a lot of loud noises. That if the person's walking down a street and they happen to hear a bus just make, you know, one of those really loud noises, they might startle and actually feel like they're back into the situation again.
But does the noise itself, it's not necessarily that it's loud or sudden or anything. It's just that it relates in some way to the traumatic event itself, right?
Right. And also, though, sometimes increased startle response is a symptom of PTSD. So any kind of loud noise, if the person's like, you know, why am I so jumpy? You know, the noises didn't really bother me that much before. So it could be that noises might bother the person more.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mentioned at the top of the show that you use cognitive behavioral therapy. It's called exposure and response prevention.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
It is a type of therapy in which, I'm so tempted to use the tripping example.
No, go ahead. It's fine. I've been warned. I'll keep my distance. No worries.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No, just if we go back to that example,
yeah.
So then it's bothering me. So I go, and just to your credit, if I was experiencing that, it would be all people, not all people, but many people that I cross in my path.
Right.
I might imagine myself tripping them. So if I'm doing exposure and response prevention, basically what I would do, eventually I would want to be exposed to the thing that's creating the anxiety without doing the safety behaviors. So in therapy, what we would do is we would actually, at some point, and this is created on a hierarchy, so we would create exposures in the low level anxiety range, in the medium level, and the high level.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if I said to the person, how high of anxiety on a scale of 0 to 10, if you and I were to walk outside right now, because in therapy doing exposure, we do a lot of sometimes going outside the office. If we were walking outside, and let's say we were to the next person that crosses our path, we're actually going to purposely envision that thing that scares you, which is you purposely, you know, we wouldn't purposely stick out our leg, but we purposely put that thought in our head because that's what scares the person.
Okay.
And then what we're going to do is we're not going to look back and we're not going to check. And they might say, wow, that would be a 10. I would be so anxious. And to me, we'd write that on the list as a 10, but then what we would do is say, okay, what if we did that in here right now with me?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think because we're in the office and it's you, I think it'd be a 7.
Okay.
Maybe because they really do want to trip me. No, I'm kidding. But like, it'd be a 7. But we try to get it lower. And that's where we start, is lower. And we would do that over and over again without them checking to make sure that something hadn't happened. And eventually what happens is, even though the person is exposed to the thing that's very scary to them, their anxiety, it will spike, but then it will go down, even though they continue to be in the presence of what scares them. And that's called habituation. And that's when the anxiety part of the brain is actually learning that this thing is not harmful, whatever the situation is. And then gradually in therapy, we would work our way up the hierarchy. And
when is it appropriate to do therapy like that, which is basically just saying we want to get you out of the habit of feeling this way?
Mm-hmm.
And when is it more appropriate to do other things?
There's, before we would ever do exposure and response prevention, we would get into the, give them some skills. So we would do some other cognitive behavioral, like Steve, I think, that called in earlier, was talking about Dr. Burns' work. There's a lot of tools we can use to give them the ammunition to kind of go and do those exposures. So it's appropriate. One, if the person's willing. If they're not willing, we never do exposures. You know, we talk about maybe why they're still avoiding it. But also, if they have a different kind of mood disorder, we may not do exposures as well. So we would be analyzing that.
We have an email from Amy who asks if you could discuss, again, best practice treatments for anxiety disorders, but specifically your thoughts about biofeedback as a treatment option for individuals who have not had relief from traditional CBT.
I have heard, you know, good things about biofeedback. I've not been trained on it myself.
What is biofeedback?
Well, essentially, you know, with the form that I'm familiar with, is there are actually, you know, computer programs and devices that you can hook yourself up to. Well, it would be in a clinical setting, but it monitors your heart rate, it monitors, you know, your levels of distress, physiological distress, and then it's sort of a way of being able to train yourself to relax and sort of control those levels. And you actually, it's nice because we have, you know, all the technology today. The computer actually helps us see how we're doing with that. And so whereas before, traditional relaxation type therapy, we don't really have a monitor. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know how we feel, but in that way, you're sort of able to train yourself how to relax, and you're actually really seeing results.
So you can sort of focus on the numbers of beats per minute, you know, or something like that, or blood pressure or something, and follow the numbers down. It sounds like it's sort of like an attempt to reverse that cycle we were talking about before.
It is, yeah. That from what I know, and like I said, I am not, you know, highly trained on that or anything. I know research-wise, one of the, right now, cognitive behavioral therapy, specifically exposure and response prevention in conjunction at times with medication, is the treatment of choice for most anxiety disorders. So not to discount biofeedback, because I definitely think it can be helpful. I think sometimes if people have not been responsive to CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, one of the things they might think about is also did, you know, maybe was it the type of CBT that was most helpful to them? Or sometimes it can, you know, I'm a counselor too, and I say this to people all the time, you know, sometimes my style might not fit with the person. So I always encourage people to definitely give CBT and exposure and response prevention a try, sometimes even a retry, maybe even, you know, helping them find another therapist or something, and you know, just to see if they can, if it's different, you know.
Mm-hmm. We're taking your questions and comments about obsessive compulsive disorder and related anxiety disorders for licensed clinical professional counselor Shayla Parker from Kevin Elliott Counseling in Champaign. You can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we'll take more of your phone calls and emails after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing OCD and related anxiety disorders with Shayla Parker, a licensed clinical professional counselor from Kevin Elliott Counseling in Champaign. We welcome your questions and comments, whether you yourself suffer from an anxiety disorder or someone close to you is dealing with such a disorder, or maybe you'd just like to know a little bit more about this particular area of mental health. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll go next now to Pam in Urbana. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I had a maybe a kind of a general question, but I was wondering how the issue of parents, you know, physically disciplining their children, especially when they're very little, how that enters into this. Just the idea that, you know, the parent figure is like the ultimate protector of the child and the nurturer of the child, and the idea that they would, and they try to protect their children from physical pain, and the fact that, you know, they could inflict, though, physical punishment, spanking or whatever, how that kind of generally would enter into problems of this sort.
Yeah, I think, you know, parents, obviously, they are sort of the child's first experience of anybody, really, usually, in most cases. And so they are very influential. And I think, you know, I guess if I were to make recommendations, I guess, to parents and things like that, it would, you know, of course, parents do have to discipline their children, and it's very important to discipline to protect them, you know. And I think a well-rounded approach would be maybe an area to strive for. So I know earlier we were talking about if a child was going close to a lake, of course, a parent would say, oh, you know, my gosh, let's not get too close to the lake. And that's a very normal, understandable response. And I think it's interesting to kind of think, okay, then what do I want to teach this child about water in that example. So it's always kind of trying to go back to being the teacher for that child, and a parent really is the first teacher. So it might be, you know, water can be very dangerous, especially if we, you know, if it's deep, but it's also really fun, you know, and so there's a lot of fun things and good things about water. So that's an idea of a response that we want to present all the aspects, discipline-wise, too. Obviously, I guess I would just say that, you know, of course, if there was physical punishment, and I know this is an opinion and everybody has different opinions, but if there's physical punishment, I think essentially what's going to, you know, there's a chance, obviously, that that person who's experiencing the physical punishment is definitely possibly going to have some anxiety in those situations, because anxiety is the body's protection mechanism. And anytime the body is in potential harm, it's going to activate that anxiety response. So it would make sense that when somebody's being disciplined, and if they're being disciplined in a physical way, they're going to possibly have a more of an anxiety response, because that's what that response is supposed to do in us. And it's interesting, because when we're anxious, we don't learn as much. You know, it's hard because our body's just paying attention to protecting itself. So if we really want to discipline, we might want to try to be more of those teachers and to help provide a teaching environment.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go next to Ken in Champaign. Hi, Ken.
Yeah, hi. Short-term memory and anxiety. So we know as we age, it becomes shorter, which I refer to as short-term memory.
Yeah.
So, or maybe even nanoseconds or whatever.
I'm sorry, what were you talking about?
Yeah, right. And what program is this?
Right, exactly.
Who am I? I know who I am. Who are you? Okay. So in terms of comment, and I know people have different ways to deal with it. Sometimes you have to laugh at it, I guess, whatever. So I'll just go off the air and you can discuss it, okay?
Okay. So yeah, what impact can anxiety have on our ability to maintain short-term memory? Is there a connection there?
Yeah. Actually, with depression and anxiety, there can definitely be some short-term memory difficulty. And definitely with anxiety, what's interesting is sometimes people, I think, are diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, and that certainly does exist. People definitely can have that diagnosis. But what's interesting is sometimes if it's not explored a little bit more of what's going on in the situations where you're not able to pay attention, you know, if somebody is having physical symptoms, say they're sitting in a classroom at school and their heart's beating really fast and because they're thinking about doing a presentation, which again is normal mm-hmm. anxiety, but you're not going to remember as much about that lecture than you would if maybe you had lower levels of anxiety. So I definitely think it impacts concentration and short-term memory too.
Let's go next to Tom in Urbana. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm curious about your actual therapy. How would you reenact something physical, say a person getting hit by a car or someone who had been in the military and had experienced a bomb of some sort?
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah, I'm wondering how you would actually go about reenacting that.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. It's a great question.
That's a really good question. Yes, there are definitely experiences we cannot recreate in the therapy setting. And so the way that we do that is doing imaginal exposure is one kind, which is basically, and again, this would be a gradual process, having the person recount their experience, basically, and what they remember from it. Often what this will look like is at first it's more of a general recollection, because usually when there's been a trauma, you know, there's a numbness that's associated with it. So it'll be more general. And then we really start to get into more of the intense okay, and what did that look like? What did that feel like? What did that smell like? What it really trying to get into the situation? Because when somebody's experiencing PTSD, now the thing that is so troublesome to them is the memory of the event, and the feeling of re-experiencing that event. The event happened, and unfortunately we can't change that. But the thing that is now creating the problem for the person is the memory of the event and the feeling of the event. So what we do is the exposure to the memory and the feeling of the event.
Gotcha. We have an email from June, and she asked a question I wanted to ask you anyway. She says, I have health anxiety, and I get many scary physiological symptoms that my general practitioner says have no basis in real illness. How would cognitive behavioral therapy work in my situation, as I don't think I'm consciously avoiding anything? And she also asks, can medication make you better, or is it a crutch you use for the rest of your life?
Let's see. Well, medication in general definitely can be a huge help, and it does not always have to be forever. So a lot of these medications might be used to help symptoms reduce somewhat, and I think it can also, if somebody's experiencing really intense symptoms, sometimes as you could imagine, if they're already having anxiety, and then to think about doing a therapy that is actually going to expose them to some more anxiety, it's sometimes really hard depending on how intense their symptoms are. So the medication can help, and often that might even be just for a year or two. And then the person can decide whether they want to stop or not. But with health anxiety, I didn't mention this earlier, but this is a really good thing that she brings up here, is sometimes the avoidance. So anxiety behaviors, safety behaviors can be avoidance, or they can be reassurance seeking behavior. So sometimes when people are having health anxiety, one of the safety behaviors might be doing a lot of research on the internet, and this becomes very time consuming for people, but it, you know, they just kind of keep seeking that reassurance. Sometimes it means going to the doctor repeatedly, and that would be the behavior that's actually helping to perpetuate the anxiety in that feedback loop. So what we would do in therapy is we'd look at the thought patterns. If they are having physical symptoms, what are they? And maybe we could even, there are interoceptive exposures where we actually, if somebody has a, you know, panic, for example, and they don't like their heart beating that fast, then one of the things we do is try to help them be desensitized to feeling so fearful of that. So we would be jogging in place, or we might be doing
push-ups. Do things that naturally increase the heart rate in a healthier way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think there is today still a stigma attached to mental health disorders like anxiety that doesn't exist when it comes to purely physical maladies?
I do. I definitely do. I think it's definitely getting better, which is wonderful. And I think I'm hoping that keeps changing, and thanks to people like you guys that getting this information out there will help people realize this definitely is a medical issue. When you do brain scans of people, say with OCD, for example, we can actually see that the circuitry operating in the brain is functioning slightly different than someone without OCD. And so this is, it's physical, it's the way the brain is functioning, and it's real. And we can see it now on these brain scans. But unfortunately, mental health does not have as much access to, they're expensive, these brain scans, and it's not common to have yet, but I think it's going to get better, which is good.
We have just a few moments left. What drew you to focus on specifically anxiety disorders? What interests you about this and in the grand scheme of the mental health field?
I think it's because when I heard Dr. McGrath, who started the anxiety program at Linden Oaks Hospital, I heard him talk. He was the first person I ever heard describe exposure and response prevention. And looking at the research and seeing the amount of symptom reduction people can experience with cognitive behavioral therapy, people who tend to respond to therapy experience a 60 to 80% symptom reduction, which I think is just so appealing, because I love seeing people feel better, and I love seeing people be able to do things in their life that maybe they felt like anxiety was a block for them. And it's really neat. So a lot of, I make a joke with people when I see them in the office. I said, you know, my goal is to help you get better, but I got to admit to you, you know, one of the things I really enjoy in life is seeing people get better. So it actually kind of helps. I guess it benefits me too, but that's why I like working with people who are suffering with anxiety.
Shayla Parker is a licensed clinical professional counselor from Kevin Elliott Counseling in Champaign. She specializes in treatment of patients with anxiety disorders. Shayla, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me today. Thank you.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, we'll listen back to a conversation from early September with Jim Holt, author of the book, Why Does the World Exist? In it, Holt traces efforts to grasp the origins of the universe and suggests along the way that many discussions revolving around the classic question, why are we here, are simply too narrow, that there are many more possible answers than the old God versus the Big Bang debate would suggest. Holt talks with philosophers, physicists, and a Buddhist monk, among others, as he seeks big answers to the biggest of questions. That's on tomorrow's show. Then on Wednesday, we'll talk with biographer Harlow Giles Unger about the sixth president of the United States, John Quincy Adams. Maybe no other figure in American history impacted that history in more ways and bore witness to it in more key moments than John Quincy Adams. We'll tell you why that is, how that is. That's on Wednesday's show. Today's program was produced by Travis Stanzel. Jason Croft is our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen.